his name? Gene Clayton? Skitch Murphy? No. Oh, I remember. Of course. Spells his name with a J. Hang it up big. Oh, by the way, I've noticed that you're doing something about that limp. It's very good. You're faking it good, yes. And about that bad look you got on your face, I suggest that the... Well, you can see that it's the result of a lot of practice. You don't get anything really truly beautifully realized unless you do practice it. Right, gang? Oh, this poor guy. Anthony Van Rensenberg, 7, has 30 known allergies. Doctors say he must avoid eggs, milk, grass, wool, flowers, bristles, moss, cereals, cats, rabbits, dogs, and most people, and an assortment of high-protein foods. He can, however, have bubble gum, fruit, and candy. The only things... Oh, what a great disease to have. Wouldn't you like to find out that the only thing you're not allergic to is bourbon? And, please, Nick, if you will, let's celebrate that. That was kind of a nice comment. Let's... Where the purple peacock spreads its lovely fans. Hindu. Yeah, Hindustan. A little juice harp would go real good here. Nick, that's an ugly instrument. That's ugly, ugly, ugly instrument. I just wish that Shepard would stop playing that terrible thing. Oh, uggish. Hey, listen, I'm going to have to ask your indulgence tonight. Little experiment here tonight. I thought I'd bring you in on it. It's springtime, all this stuff coming on. The other day, one of the official types here walked into my office. And, of course, immediately he was inundated. All the stuff fell down all around him. And, yes, my office takes roughly 6 to 8 weeks after I've cleaned it to become uninhabitable then after that. You know, stuff piles up until eventually every time you open the door, it's worse than Fibber McGee's famous closet. Well, yes, it is. I'll tell you why it is, because I've got roaches living in it on the top of my desk. Now, I didn't hear anything about that, you know, in connection with Fibber. But, he came in the other day, and he tried to get in my office. See, well, I've given up. I sit out in the hall now. See, I left my office as a separate entity. So, you know, once in a while, in the great big pile of stuff, I hear my phone ringing, sadly. See, and I can't get at it. So, he came in, see, and he took one look at the office. He said, listen now. He said, you ever heard of spontaneous combustion? I said, yeah. He said, well, there's smoke coming from the bottom drawer. And he said, you better do something about it because, he says, you know, not only that, he says, I noticed 7 rats leaving that pile on top of your desk. He says, either you're going to get fired, and the rats know it, or, by the way, wouldn't it be a terrible thing, guy sitting in his famous, you know, fancy office, big low carpet on the floor, you know, the whole bit, and he's sitting there in the office, and all of a sudden, out of his private, you know, the big thing that an executive gets these days is his own private John. Did you know that? Did you know that that's one of the big... genuine status symbols in a big organization. You know, you've always heard the whole idea of the executive washroom. Well, that's for the hoi polloi executive. All he gets is a key, so, you know, he can go in there with a lot of other guys. But the real status symbol is to have your own little place. You see, it's a little John there, and the shower and a whole bit. And so, guy's sitting at his desk. I can just see this moment. See, he's sitting at his desk. He's got a big little carpet on the floor. And he's got 7 phones, pink, blue, green, yellow, to show, you know, in varying degrees of importance. Did you know that some guys have color-coded phones? And the girl in front of his office, you know, his secretary, whenever he gets a call, say, from a totally unimportant dildoc, but he should say something to him, you know, just a totally unimportant klutz, the blue phone rings. He picks up the blue phone and says, "What do you want, jerk?" You know, and, okay, well, then, let's say Buddha calls, or let's say Tom O'Neill calls, some, you know, fantastic appointments. Well, that is the, you know, the special phone rings, the gold phone rings. And at that point, he picks it up and says, hello, sir, you see, because she's warning him of the phone, you see, and he has all these phones all around him. And now that's part of the status of... Hey, speaking of status of executives, did you see... The world is getting so kooky, you can't believe it sometimes. I mean, it's getting completely out of hand. And everybody's playing a role. Did you see... Now, what do they call it now? I want to make sure that I get the terminology right here because it's important. What do they call... The Houston Space Center... It's called Center Control. Mission Control. Yeah, Mission Control. That's right. All right. Do you know that you can now buy? You know, there's places that cater only to executive types. Only. And incidentally, how many of you have got some credit card that, in a moment of rashness, you applied for this credit card, and the next thing you know, you are on this fantastic sucker list. Of this sucker mail that keeps coming to you, and they keep thinking that you want to buy on your credit card a trip to Japip, you know, you want to take a round-the-world trip, or you want to buy a matched set of luggage with raised embossed Diners Club insignia on the outside, you know, that kind of jazz. So anyway, I got this letter from this outfit. See, they're under the mistaken impression that Shepard is an executive because he's got a credit card. They relate executive credit cards. See, well, I am about as much of an executive, you know, as your Aunt Em. But nevertheless, I get this list of stuff that I can get now that I'm this big executive. See, I can get these great things. Do you know that I can now get, and you can't too, it's what a cockamamie this is, you can get an executive, a little Echo Chamber would help on this, Nick, executive mission control headquarters. And you put it on your desk. It's a great big thing that goes from one end of your desk to the other, and they have a special desk devised for it. It's like a U-shaped desk, and it's a control board like a B-17, Nick, that goes all the way around. And the guy can sit in there and play the role, see? And this mission control executive deck control center, it says, all executives must keep in constant touch with the entire world. Yes, the modern-day executive today controls millions of people in all parts of the globe. So, the Mission Control Executive Desk Set will fill a great need among dynamic, hard-hitting, modern 20th century global control executives. And what does it have? Well, it has a little Sony TV set so that you can switch on. Immediately, you're in touch with David Brinkley. See, clump like that, David Brinkley's talking to you. Then they have an FM set. You can immediately switch on and listen to some little guy on an FM, you know, talking about Mozart. Then you can switch over here. Yeah, and they have tape players. They have, yeah, it's all around. You have a switch, and it's got control, and it's got a checklist. Every day, you go through the checklist. You know, the executives pretend they're at the helm of a vast spaceship flying through eternity. And so you have this whole thing around, and then it has in it, it has built-in intercom, see, so you can call your girl, you see, in the next office. You remember Andrew H. Brown of Amos and Andy? He used to say, buzz me, Miss Blue. You see, somebody who hooked up his desk set hooked it up wrong, and he couldn't buzz his girl, and she could only buzz him. So when he wanted to talk to her, he would say, buzz me, Miss Blue, and she'd go, He'd say, what do you want, Miss Blue? She said, well, you buzz me. It's where you... I just want to make sure it's all working. Buzz me again. So thank you, Miss Blue. It's working fine. Any messages come through, you put them right through here. Well, this, of course, this whole problem the executive desk is an important thing today. And one of the most important aspects of an executive desk today, you can measure the importance of an executive's desk by how little he has on it. That shows he is not bothered with trivia. He does not bother with the scut of other people's lives, and like filling out papers, in, out, all the, you know, clipping stuff together and all that. And so when you go into a really important executive, he's going one step further. No desk. He has eliminated the desk because, you see, the desk is associated with work. It is a symbol for work. And the ultimate executive prerogative is you relieve him of work, you see. He's so important, he doesn't have... So you go into the really top executive's office now, and he has no desk. And, oh, by the way, don't ever call a top executive... His office is what it really is. Don't ever call it an office. It is called his executive suite. And, the whole mythology of executive world is, you know, it, until ultimately, the ultimate executive, you see, if he slowly cuts off all connection with the world, which is what being an executive means, the higher up you go, the less you have to do with the mailroom, you know, with the boys and cost accounting, any of that stuff. So finally, you get totally rarefied. And now you're in sort of a cloud where, you know, you're like God. It's one-way communication where, you know, you don't communicate with God. He communicates with you. How does he do it? Lightning bolts. Wham. That's all. And so the ultimate executive has only one button on his desk, if he has a desk. It's the lightning bolt button. And so... Yeah, that's right. So whenever he is displeased, see, God is displeased. He presses this button, and throughout the entire organization, this is God. Get on the stick. The 23rd floor is fired. Bum, ba-dum, bum. And as a hush falls over the entire organization from coast to coast, God has fired the 23rd floor. Or else, it gets even bigger than this. I have known executives to do this. Button pressed. This is God. Cell, plant number 14, dispose of United Airlines. Immediately. Bum, ba-dum, bum. Thousands and thousands of scurrying employees. Now, only one thing, that a vast, mysterious force has just dealt them a totally lethal blow. Their company has been sold to the Cockamamie Fish Canning Company. The whole thing's changed. Everything except God. He remains eternal. He goes on and on. Give me a little God music, please. That's a big, big disc. That's it. Yes, he remains eternal. Subtle and eternal. Indefinably. Totally inexplicable. One doesn't explain God. One doesn't Indian wrestle with God. And the great thunder clouds roll out of those vast suites beyond all time. This is God. This is the voice. The man. Reset that quick, Nick. That is an order. I love to give orders. That is an order. That is an order. And by the way, you find how tremendously effective this is in your private life. Now, let's say you're having trouble with your chick, right, Nick? Okay? You're sitting on the white horse, right? Or the lion's head, right? And this chick is going,
why did we go up to 57? I want to go to a movie.
All right, you know, this jazz is coming your way. Turn to her and say, I've heard enough. That is an order. That cools. Quick. One way or the other, you discover a lot of things that minute. You may discover things you don't want to discover, but that's all right. You should know them, whether you want to discover them or not. And you know, I'm waiting for the day, though, when meetings are genuinely staged. Now, the other day, I went to a top-level meeting, and I was hit by the fact that everybody came in and sort of sat around his table, you know, a lot of executive types, and they sort of slumped in, you know, and sat down. Oh, no, there's going to be a day when the really top executive realizes that every scene, every move of a top executive must be totally orchestrated. Who knew this? The great dictators of history. You don't think that Castro shows up at the pool room, do you? Oh, he shows up on a vast balcony at a precise moment when the crowd has been raised to a fever pitch for the band's playing, and a hooray for Castro, C-A-S-T-R-O, hooray, Yankee, go home, rah, rah, hooray, ta, ta, ta. They're playing whatever it is, see, and then, at the precise moment, the cannons boom, and out steps the Pope, out steps Castro, out steps Hitler. Hitler had a fantastic office. It was all lit. Did you know that? Tremendous. You didn't just walk into this guy's little office. There were guards with uniforms and the whole business. And I'm waiting for the day when the proper production values are added to every man's life. And so here it is now. First of all, the decor of a meeting room must be prepared. It must look vaguely Westminster Abbey-ian. I mean, this is where greatness walks. You do not meet in the John and the 23rd Street subway, friends. This is where greatness walks, and you have these high arched ceilings with a touch of Gothic, which is eternal, see? A little stained glass window wouldn't hurt either. I mean, you can fake it. You can, you know, get the stained glass window. You don't actually have to have windows. You know, you have these lights that flicker behind it that look a little like lightning playing outside someplace in the outside world. And everyone assembles now at this vast table that is made of stone. It's taken from Stonehenge, like a vast slab of eternal Mother Earth. The men assemble, various vice presidents, executives ranging from the medium grade minor to the senior medium major, right? They're waiting. The lights dim after a 5-minute wait. A hush falls over the group of assembled deep thinkers. The lights dim even lower. There's a flicker of lightning in the stained glass windows. And then out of 1,000 tiny loudspeakers, cleverly concealed in the damask tapestry that show the signing of the Magna Carta, woven in the 15th century, the sound of beautifully contrived, selected, programmed and orchestrated music rises. And at a vast empty chair at the far end of the table, carved out of living lava, a purple light focuses on the gold damask seat. The assembled executives lean forward. They feel in the presence something vast and unknowably powerful is near. last organ chord sounds. And out of the purple darkness, a puff of electric smoke. Cleverly contrived. Yeah, just reset it, Nick. That's all you gotta do. A quick puff of smoke. And seemingly out of the blackness of the light, the world, out of all time itself, out of God knows where, poof, he appears magically. Faint green and silver lights play over his noble visage. J.W. Fuller is among us. For one brief instant in time, all the men know that they are alone with their maker. But there is a moment of true satori, a moment of communion. He smiles broadly. All right, men. Who could ever fire a guy like that? See, there's two kinds of people in this world, friends. Them what gets fired and them what fires. This is WOR in New York. And, oh, yeah. You like that, Nick? You like that scene? Can't you imagine that scene? I was just... I mean, let's face it. Secretly, we're theatrical creatures. We are. You know, we're the only animal that does this. You know, that deals with theatrical things. That a lion does not recognize the fact that he is majestic. He does not. All he knows, he's hungry or he ain't. That's all. And when he's hungry, he just kills something. That's all. And when he's not, he just sits around and sleeps. And I've been in the company of lions of many types. In fact, I remember the first time I ever saw a lion live and wild, I was hit by that. I mean, here's a lion laying under a tree, you know, a big lion. This was not in a park. I mean, he's a working lion, see? He's laying under a tree, and he's got about three other lions around him, lesser lions. This is a real lion, a great big mane, a male lion, Simba. And he's laying there. And you know, of course, that all the hunting, or most of the hunting, is done by the female lion. The fighting is done by the male lion. That's right. You know, that's like, you know, the male lion looks on hunting like going to the D'Agostino. See, this is something that the ladies do. See, they go to the D'Agostino. He's not going to be bothered with that stuff. But when it comes to a good, you know, good knockdown, drag-out fight, the male lion is right there on top of it. So he's laying under the tree, see, and I'm watching him. It's a lion. Now, I know I'm going to immediately get a lot of letters from people saying, what do you mean? Lions, we are very harmless creatures. Forget it. Listen, every warden that I met in Central Africa said they don't know where this cockamamie idea ever came out that the lion is a harmless creature. By the way, you know that the people in Central Africa who know lions best look upon Elsie. What was that thing? What was it called? Forever Free? Born Free. To them, that is one of the best comedies ever made. They think that's a great comedy film. You know, everybody petting lions and all that. But nevertheless, I took a look at this lion, see? And he is laying under a tree. And there's a couple of other big lions. One of them was asleep. A couple of female lions. A couple of cubs. And this great big one. Oh, wow. He must have... You know, he was like half again the size of all the rest. And had this tremendous dark mane. It's a special kind of lion, see? And he's just looking around. And you could see off in the distance a herd of impala. And they're walking around being what impalas are. You know, they just walk around, chew the grass. That's about it. But let me tell you this. When an impala moves, he moves like no animal you ever saw in your born life. Woo-hoo! Boy, do they go. Fantastic jumpers. They move like grasshoppers. The first thing that hit me when I saw impala, and there's a couple of other antelopes that do that over there, that I'm hit by not their resemblance to animals when they move, but insects. that have you ever walked amid a field of grasshoppers, and the grasshoppers are flying all over the place, and they go like 20 feet in the air, and they just sail off? Well, that's the way impalas are. And in fact, I saw a herd of impalas being attacked by a herd of one of the most vicious animals in the entire African lexicon, the wild dog. Did you know that the wild dog, the dog in his wild state, is one of the most vicious animals? Vicious to other animals. Now, of course, he's just living. He's not. There is no vicious in the jungle, by the way. I'm making no value judgment. In the bush, there is no vicious. There is only the hungry and the eaten. That's all. That's really what it boils down to. And an animal that's hungry eats. Are you being vicious when you eat a cheeseburger? No, you're hungry. You know, you don't think of yourself as being some kind of a carnivore that's eaten a steer. And but nevertheless, that's the way it is with an animal. So one of the most wild scenes I ever saw in a jungle. It's not a jungle, I should say the East African bush. And we were very fortunate because this is a rare animal. The wild dog is a rare creature. And he's a tall, spotted dog. He looks a little like what you would consider to look like, something like a jackal, really. But he's got big ears that look like the Mickey Mouse Club ears. You know, the Mickey Mouse Club, you've seen these ears? The first time I saw one of these things, they look strangely humorous. You have to kind of laugh at them. And they got very high forelegs. Their forelegs are high, and their back sort of slants down a little bit. And their rear is kind of narrow and rather low to the ground compared to the front. And they've got a short, arcing tail. And it sort of bends up. And he's got a kind of pointed nose. It looks a little bit like roughly like a German Shepherd nose. And his face is a little like a German Shepherd. It's a long, narrow face. But he's got these strange, big, round ears that stick up like a couple, like he's wearing a Mickey Mouse Club hat, you know? And so he looks kind of wild, like kind of cute, you know? You think, gee, what a cute animal. And he's a brown colored, but a dark brown, and he's got sort of yellowish kind of spots on him. And his back is almost black. It looks like he's got a black stripe running down the back. And you rarely see these in all of this area in the Kruger area, the game preserve area there, which is in the upper part of South Africa. There were less than 200 of these. It's a very rare species. Well, suddenly, out of the bush, they came. Just poof, like that. The guy that was with me, the guide, I don't know why I'm telling you this story, do you find it interesting? The guide who was with me had been in this area for 11 years and had never seen a wild dog. Now, he's daily among these animals, so that's how hard it is to see them. And suddenly this crowd came out of this bush. They just, bup, they're there. You don't see them come. You don't see them go. They just suddenly appear. And they're running alongside of us, absolutely paying no attention to us. And we're in a Jeep. And they're paying no attention. They're just running along. And there must have been about 10 or 11 of them. And they run just like you see. You know when you look out and you see a bunch of stray dogs running in a pack? That's the way they run. They just sort of running along, looking very casual, looking around, see, up, 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 they're running. And there's a couple of bigger ones and a bunch of smaller, but they're all about the same size. And they're running along, and they look kind of friendly. Well, then suddenly they drop. They just instantly drop down into the grass, which is about, 2 or 3 feet high. It's thick grass there. They drop down into this yellow grass, and all you see are these round ears. You see a whole bunch of round ears. You know, it's like the Mickey Mouse Club has gone underground. You know, you see a lot of round ears. And one of them, now, the scene was so dramatic, it was almost impossible to believe. One of them is standing on a rock, pointing, just exactly the way a pointer points. And he is pointing. His gut is pulled in, and he's just standing there pointing, leaning forward. He's at a point. And all the others have dropped down. And we are saying nothing. The guide is watching. His eyes are popping like ping pong balls. They're wild dogs. He says, watch, they're hunting. And they're standing up like this. This one guy is pointing. He's just pointing. And sure enough, you see off in the distance what he's pointing at. There's a herd of impala, which is one of the prettiest creatures in the world. And the impala, probably among the animals, has to be one of the three or four most beautiful creatures by our standards, by human standards, it's just a magnificent creature. Tiny, thin, extremely alert, and tremendously fast. Actually, they're not so fast. They put it this way, they're highly airborne. They're fast, but it's almost all in the air. They bound like crickets, or like you don't see them really walking. They just go bing, bing, bing. They fly over the ground like grasshoppers. And here's this dog watching. He's pointing, and you see this herd of impalas slowly moving. They're feeding, and they're moving from left to right in the general direction of these dogs, who are upwind, or downwind, rather, of these impala. They always work downwind, because the impala has a fantastic sense of smell, too. And the dog's sense of smell is incredible. So he just waits. And they just watch. Not a sound. You can hear whale. Well, there are some sounds in the bush, because this was the middle of the afternoon. It was a kind of a grayish, cloudy day, and the temperature was 102, 103. Silence. And, you know, the curious thing about being in the bush is that you're aware of things all around you that you don't see. You just know they're there. And so way off in the distance, you'll hear something. It'll go a little like this. That's the way the bush sounds in the middle of the afternoon. Something way off is barking, something is howling, something is grunting, something is calling, bell-like sounds. And then there's always something about every half hour that lets out a very strange sound, a little like this. And it stops. You won't hear them again. Some kind of a bird. And they have some fantastic insects there. Like an insect will start out. It's an insect. Silence. You can feel it and hear it. And all around you, you sense life. Tremendous life. Everywhere. And you see this wild dog. Standing on this rock, just tensed, not moving a muscle. And the impala are quietly grazing, totally unaware. And they just graze. Once in a while, one looks up, flicks his horns, his antler. They have these short, arcing horns. And I was watching them through the glasses as they moved. And you see little tiny ones running in and out among them. They just move along. Until they got opposite us. Now the dogs were between us and the impala. The impala was about, the herd was about a half a mile from us. Maybe less than, a little less, but very close. But possibly twice the length of a football field. I'd say maybe 200 yards, roughly. The dogs were halfway between. One without any warning. Just like that. It just happened without, just mysteriously. You saw the entire pack of dogs just make a big fan, and just, wow, they went out in a big circle like that, and all the impala, boop, 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 they're flying like mad, and these dogs are moving through the herd of the impala. You see this great cloud of dogs, and then the animals begin to bark. You hear things warning other things that a raid is going on. You hear birds yelling, and you see these impala flying in the air, and then they concentrate on one. And the herd of impala moves off into a great splattered kind of a puddle, just scattered to the wind. And you see this crowd of dogs moving through the bush, and you see one impala going higher and higher and higher, and they disappear. They're gone. You know how they do it? The dogs don't pull the animal down. They're one of the very few creatures, if not the only creature, that eats its prey alive. The way they do it is they run alongside the impala and literally bite bites out of him. They're feeding. They're not trying to kill him. They're feeding as he runs. And they just literally eat him until finally a loss of blood and everything else contrives to get him, and he dies right there. Then they don't eat him anymore. Then they go after another one. They're a very odd and strange creature, and that would surprise a lot of people to know that this is the dog that we live with. You know, very common animal. And yet, of all the animals, Keith, curious, in the jungle or in the bush, the wild dog is considered the toughest, roughest animal there is. Rougher than a lion. And for this reason, among others, that a lion will kill one, like, say, one hartebeest. He'll kill one eland. And they'll feed off the whole crowd, and that's it. But it may take 7 or 8 or 10 impalas to feed the wild dogs that day, because they only eat them when they're running. So they, oh, they're tough. And fast, oh, they move like a shot. Now, I'm sure that the impala, or the wild dog, neither one of them knows that he's spectacular. He's beautiful. He's wild-looking. And he is. And I remember one little moment. There's a very strange moment. I'm sitting in a compound overlooking the Elephanta River. Now, this is a river because it stands for elephants, and there were elephants there. But somebody, and it's a very strange thing happening. I'm sitting there looking out of this vast, big glass window. It's just about twilight, and I can see Africa spread out for as far as the eye can see, with a fantastic landscape, really. When I use the word fantastic, I'm not using it in its popular hip usage. I'm talking about genuinely, it looks like a fantasy. You can't believe there's such a landscape. And high up in the air, way up over you, always, wherever you are in Africa, you can see these huge vultures circling, these tremendous birds just circling way up there, great black birds with an enormous wingspan, and man, can they fly. Tremendous flyers. So they're up there just laying those wings over, moving around. Now, I was sitting there. It's one of those moments that is almost so corny as to be almost unbelievable. Now, I'm looking out. It's nice and warm. It's twilight. And I have a glass of wine. And I'm sitting out on the veranda, really, looking down. Veranda was just a stone thing, high over this enormous African landscape. Somebody behind me has a radio playing. It's in this place. And the radio is playing this, well, it's Beethoven, actually, what they were playing. Can you imagine Beethoven? And Beethoven was coming out, and I'm looking down, it's this tremendously majestic music. I'm not going to play Beethoven now, but I'm going to play something like it. This is what happened. I'm sitting there, and this music is playing. You know, this tremendous Germanic music. And incidentally, I'm playing Richard Strauss here, so he's very Beethoven Germanic. See, so the music is coming out with great trumpets and tremendous chorus. And I'm sitting looking down at this river, the Elephanta River, and the sun is glinting down. When you're near the equator, there's hardly any twilight. One minute it's broad daylight, there's a brief moment of red, spectacular purple and green, and then black. Well, it's now at that red scene, and the river is looking like a molten stream of lava, this red reflection all over. And this music is playing behind me. This is unbelievable. And I see these vultures hanging high up over me, just swinging around in great swings. And all of a sudden, out of the jungle or out of the brush, right down below me, on this riverbank, came these two enormous rhinos. I don't think there is a more impressive creature in the entire lexicon of African animals than the rhinoceros. And these two rhinos came out and just walked down to the water, see, with this music playing.
fantastic.
What a scene. You know that in Africa, when you go to Africa and you're among the guides and so on there, they have a thing called the Big Five. You know what the Big Five of animals are? Like we refer to the big leagues. And they say the Big Five. Well, obviously, one of the Big Five is the lion. The lion, the elephant, that's the other one, the rhinoceros, Big Five. What do you think No, it's the Big Four. What's the other big animal that they all want to see? Another fantastic creature. That's right. If you have the reset in that, Nick, I'll show you what happened with me with him. I was lucky enough on that particular trip to have been involved or been very close to all of the Big Four, the tremendous animals. And this has to be one of the most impressive animals in the world. I mean, it has to be. It is. There's no question about it. This fantastic animal. And how he came out was interesting, too. That we had stopped to actually stopped our Jeep on this road, and we were having a drink, a Coke, actually. It was a cold Coke. It was very hot, so he says, let's stop and have a Coke for a minute. And we were drinking a Coke, and they were passing around sandwiches. There were four of us in the Jeep. When there were clearings all around, you see, the bush is not the jungle. You know, people tend to confuse bush and jungle, and they're not the same thing at all. A jungle, of course, is a jungle. It's a great growth of trees, and this is found in areas where there's a lot of moisture. It's found in the Central Congo and so on. But where the big animals are, the really big creatures, this is bush. Now, what is the bush? Well, the bush consists really of little, it's bush, really, little trees that aren't more than certain African types of trees. They're really like bushes. They're probably 15, 20 feet high. And the ground is very clear under them. You can see things. In other words, there's openings and clearings. It's really partly plain. It's very flat country. And occasionally you'll see one tall tree will stick up off in the distance, one tall African tree. And on that tree, there are usually two or three baboons playing around it, or warthogs play around a big tree like that. And then way off in the distance, you'll generally see, this is a strange landscape, you'll see one mountain standing off, sort of purple and blue. And this is the way this part of Africa looks. And this is where the big game is. Well, we were sitting in our Jeep having a Coke, when all of a sudden, the guy, who was very hip to animals, of course, this is his whole world, he says, shh, shh, wait. He's there, look, over there. He says, see, he said, past. He said, do you see that antelope there? He said, just past the antelope, watch. See that dark patch there? Watch. And we're all sitting watching. Shh, shh, watch. See, he's moving now. Watch him. He's moving. And you saw a flick of dark, a dark skin behind this green bush. We were all watching carefully. There he is. Here he's coming out now. You couldn't believe it. I had a pair of binoculars, Zeiss glasses on. A giant Cape buffalo. What an animal. The tremendous horns, you know, this tremendous head of not antlers, this great curving, sweeping horn. He has a head that's about the size of the average Ford Maverick. And his body, nothing but solid, black, rippling muscles. And he seems to be shiny, moist, like he's perspiring. And on his back are three or four birds that are picking, you know, things off of him. And he just walks out to this clearing, this enormous Cape buffalo. He just flings his head. Oh, hit it. What an animal. What an animal. A Cape buffalo. Wow. Whee! Well, of course, you can talk about animals all you want, but another wild, great creature that makes you laugh. You just can't help it, and yet he's so beautiful that you can't believe it's a wild animal. You just can't. Are you interested in this, Nick? The animals? A lot of people, you know, find, you know, but to me, the world we live in is so infinitely interesting. But I'm sorry for people who don't look around at the world at all. You know, they really don't. To them, the world consists of a room with an air conditioner, a TV set. And there's another animal though that I think I want the other cut on that, and I'll give you the cue. Just I'll let you know, because this animal is so funny, you can't help but laugh when he shows up on the scene, and you want to go out and pat him or something. And yet, curiously enough, they say that this animal is not too against that. The first time that I saw this creature, I just thought, no, oh, come on, you know, you can't believe. When you go to a zoo, I don't think a zoo at any point, now I've been to millions of zoos, because I love zoos, I don't think a zoo at any point gives you even the slightest hint of the creatures that you're looking at. Now, I can say this as one who's been in this area, in these areas of the world where great creatures abound. Let me tell you, one of the most impressive creatures I think I've ever seen in my life was a live jaguar in Peru. And I mean an operating jaguar. This creature is so beautiful and so deadly. And I know you're going to write me letters and give me all the ASPCA glop about jaguars. But let me tell you this, to the people who live in the Peruvian area and in the Amazon area, the jaguar is one of the deadly scourges of the world. As a matter of fact, it's one of the few creatures that likes to eat man. It doesn't. Yeah, it does. You know, most creatures will eat man only as a last resort because apparently we got a bad taste. And thank God for that. You know that there's a lot of zoologists who feel that one of the reasons why man survived from the very earliest times in the early days of the development of man as an animal is that he is not a good tasting creature. That most of the carnivores don't like the taste of us. I mean, we're bad news. that's interesting. You know, you never think of yourself as how you taste to other animals, but apparently we have a bad taste to most carnivorous animals that are pretty broad in their feeding habits, too. They'll eat anything, but they won't eat man. It just doesn't taste good to them. The one exception, or at least one of the exceptions, is the jaguar. He likes the taste of man, and he'll go out of his way. I mean, this is a real, you know, nice little snack in the afternoon after he's been eating warthogs tapirs. They eat a lot of tapirs in that area. But this jaguar that I saw was a jaguar at dawn in the Amazon region, and all I saw was a brief flash of him. He went across a trail, and there are no roads there, so there were no jeeps involved. He just went across a trail so quick, if you blinked your eyes, you didn't see him. It just zapped, and he was gone. But that zap, that brief shot of spectacular wild color was beautiful. But the funniest one, I think, just absolutely, you can't help but laugh your gut out when you first see him, because he's so unbelievable in nature. He's unbelievable enough in a zoo, but when you see him in nature, you can't believe it. Here we are, we're driving along, when all of a sudden, we're driving in the Jeep, and the guy slams on the brakes. He says, "Look at this, man." And out of the crowd, out of the brush, you see about five, and they're moving. See, they're moving fast, and their rear ends going up and down, and their front legs are going up and down, and their necks are waving like giant snakes. There are 10 or 12 magnificent giraffes moving across, and they move up and down. And by the way, they cover ground like no other animal because of that enormous reach they've got. And they just move a lot, and then they stop. Zap! They stop. They saw us. The giraffe, in common with many other creatures of the antelope type, is extremely curious. He is very curious. Now, a lot of animals are suspicious. A lot of them will frighten easily, but most of the antelope types are curious. He stops. They all stopped in their tracks. They turn around. They sense something. Looking around, and they don't have very good eyes, apparently. This great big one. And by the way, the giraffe in nature is roughly a third larger than the ones you're used to seeing in zoos. The giraffe, the biggest giraffe ever recorded, was from neck to feet, 22 feet high. 22 feet to the top of that guy. Now, that means he's a full two stories high. The two-story building is 22 feet high. They figure 11 feet to the story. He's a two-story building. Well, when you see an animal that's two stories high in an area where the average tree doesn't grow over 10 feet, that is a fantastic animal. Well, the average one that we saw was about 18 to 20, 21 feet high, and they stand there tremendous with birds running up and down their necks, which you're not used to seeing in the zoos. And the birds are sitting on top of their heads, see, and they're all looking at us. And then he starts to feed. They feed off the top of the trees. They spread their legs out wide, and he starts chewing on the trees. See, they only eat certain trees, and he's chewing away down there. And look, I says, I'm looking at a giraffe. Shepard, you're looking at a giraffe. This ain't a zoo. It's a giraffe. I look carefully at him, and he's standing there looking happy, just looking around. Well, we drove closer to him. They're very, very curious. This is one of the reasons why so many of the antelope types are endangered species. They'll let people practically walk right up to them. He's looking. Bending his head down, you know, they have a difficult time looking down at you. See, they're looking down. Yeah, they bring their nose and their chin down. And finally, the big one, the chief, decides whatever they're looking at is dull. He didn't get scared. It's just dull. We're dull. And he just starts to slowly walk away, his head moving back and forth. And now there are 11 giraffes, and we're looking at them from behind. If you've ever seen 11 giraffes walk away from you, you have seen one of the funniest sights in nature. With the birds running up and down their neck, you know, back and forth. This beautiful giraffe. What great creatures. And you know, I can only say that I love summer. I'm glad summer's coming now, you know. It's on the way. Because all that stuff is... How many of you are varmint watchers? When you're driving your car and you wait for a raccoon to come... By the way, do you know that there is one zoologist who believes strongly that if there was some kind of fantastic holocaust in the world, two creatures would survive. The cockroach and the raccoon. The raccoon is one of the toughest of animals. He will survive anywhere. Oh, yeah. You know, it's time to breathe, time to walk, man. Time to be big and tall. You, too, are an exotic member of the zoological species, friend, and one of the most dangerous.